The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. My name is Ann Rostosky and I am today's worship leader. We're so happy you could join us. The speaker today is our friend Butch Larsenese. I think you will enjoy his talk and hopefully learn some things from it as well. So whoever you are, whoever you love, wherever you are on your spiritual path, please join us for this hour. And our opening words today come from Mao Tse, when all the people. When all the people of the world love, then the strong will not overpower the weak. The many will not oppress the few. The wealthy will not mock the poor. The honored will not disdain the humble. The cunning will not deceive the simple. And now Matthew Sayre will read the chalice lighting.
A chalice and a flame together formed a symbol of our free faith. Today's chalice lighting words are from Joel Miller, interim senior minister of First Unitarian Church of Rochester, New York. We all know loss and pain. Let none of it divide us. In the rising sun today, let us do together what we cannot do alone. Roll away the stones that close our hearts. And now, Preston Lutweiler will light the peace lamp.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with you, and with all the people of the world.
Today's gathering song is When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place. Remember to, you can sing loud because no one else can hear you. Now we have our moment for all ages. A few weeks ago, we had another story from NPR's StoryCorps, and this one seemed very fitting for today. It's two strangers that are talking in hopes of bridging their political divide. And this actually appeared or aired on NPR's Morning Edition on November 9th of 2018. I don't know if you can remember back to that time. It was an interesting time, but it seems fitting today as well.
For something a little bit different from StoryCorps. Every week, we hear excerpts from conversations between two people who know and love one another. Now, for the first time, We're going to eavesdrop on a conversation between two strangers. It's part of a new initiative which brings together people on opposite sides of the political divides to get to know one another through StoryCorps conversations. Arsenio and Israel Berryeshua, two strangers who recently sat down together in Denver. Let's listen in.
I'm a single father. I have two children. I actually grew up in Griffin Spaulding County. If you're born in that county, you have like a 16% chance of getting out of poverty. So I'm like the 16%. Mm-hmm. And I tell that to my children. There's no excuses. It comes from within.
And something that I also convey to my children. My parents grew up with nothing. My mom didn't have shoes, didn't have food, that kind of thing. And, you know, she's the one kid that put herself through college as a single parent.
Yeah. When you think about the future, what are you most scared of?
I am just really nervous for my kids, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like right now, everything is just mean and nasty.
But instead of reacting with kindness or compassion, people are quick to react with, I guess, hate or anger, and not just like me and you're doing, sitting here talking and try to understand perspectives.
Is there one thing that you respect about the way that I see the world?
No.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I think you said that you want the best for this country. I respect that view, and I agree with that view.
Okay.
Is there anything that you respect that I said today?
That you're a hardworking single father that wants what's best for his children. And I think that that's commendable and common between you and I for sure. So.
Thank you.
Strangers Tiffany Briseño, who identifies as a liberal, and Israel Berryeshua, a conservative, learning about one another as part of StoryCorps' One Small Step initiative, which seeks to remind people across the political divides of our shared humanity.
And now we'll be reading a litany of restoration. If recognizing the interdependence of all life, we strive to build community. The strength we gather will be our salvation. If you are black and I am white,
it will not matter. If you are female and I am male,
it will not matter. If you are older and I am younger,
it will not matter. If you are progressive and I am conservative,
it will not matter. If you are straight and I am gay,
it will not matter. If you are Christian and I am Jewish,
it will not matter. If we join spirits as brothers and sisters, the pain of our aloneness will be lessened. And that does matter.
In this spirit, we build community and move toward restoration. And now for our musical meditation by Pink Floyd.
Good morning. I'm Butch Larsenese, friend of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship for over a decade. My talk today is about a book that I found when I was perusing Barnes & Noble, which I tend to do in the evening, and this was in the current affairs section, and I fell in love with it. I had to buy it. It's called Love Your Enemy by Arthur C. Brooks. It's Love Your Enemy in the context of political ideologies and how we are an angry nation in this time. Arthur C. Brooks is the president of the American Enterprise Institute. He has a PhD in public policy analysis and is a conservative. He is the author of 11 books, including the bestsellers The Conservative Heart and The Road to Freedom. He is a columnist for the Washington Post and the host of the podcast, The Arthur Brooks Show. In the fall of 2019, he joined the faculty of the Harvard Kennedy School and Harvard Business School. In this book, Arthur Brooks does not defend the conservative agenda. That's not what this book is about. This book is not about any views. It's a book about understanding and healing. This man is not his political label. In one of the chapters, he asks you to look at a list, and he has a four-point list. Number one, a Spanish-speaking immigrant woman raised in poverty in a dictatorship who comes to America as a young adult and works a minimum wage job. Number two, a politically conservative young man from an upper middle class family who studies at an Ivy League university. Number three, a farmhand in rural Idaho who spends his days driving a combine and his free time hunting and fishing. Number four, a girl orphaned at birth in a small village in China who winds up against all odds living in the United States. These identities probably evoke a swift reaction in you, especially during this incredibly polarized time in America. Without knowing anything about these people except these brief descriptions, you are probably positively disposed towards one or two, but indifferent or even hostile towards the others. If I asked you what these four people have in common, your answer would probably be next to nothing. It turns out this was a trick question. Those four people are his wife of 27 years and their three children. I continually refer to this book for information and inspiration. I would like to share some of what I learned from this book. What I share is only a portion of the information in it. It's the stuff that resonated with me. This book's gifts are numerous. Now that I've talked about the author, let me talk about the book. Political scientists find that our nation is more polarized than it has been at any time since the history of the Civil War. Whether your politics are on the left, right, or center, politics just might be affecting your life. For example, a January 2017 Reuters poll found that one in six Americans had stopped talking to a family member or close friend because of the 2016 election. A far bigger share of the population has sorted out social life along ideological lines over the past few years by avoiding the places where people disagree with them, curating their news and social media to weed out opposing viewpoints, and seeking out the spaces from college campuses to workplaces where they find the most ideological compatriots. This is driving us apart, which is the last thing we need. Almost two-thirds of Americans say that the future of our country is a very significant source of stress, more than the percentage who say they are stressed by money concerns or work. Recent research shows that the dividing line in America is not race, religion, or economic status, but rather party affiliation. In 1960, only 5% of Americans said they would be displeased if their child married someone from the other political party. By 2010, that number was 40%, and no doubt has risen from there. Anyone who can't tell the difference between an ordinary Bernie Sanders supporter and a Stalinist revolutionary, or between Donald Trump's average voter and a Nazi, is either willfully ignorant or needs to get out of the house more. Today, our public discourse is shockingly hyperbolic in ascribing historically murderous ideologies to the tens of millions of ordinary Americans with whom we strongly disagree. Just because you disagree with something doesn't mean it's hate speech or the person saying it is a deviant. The vast majority of Americans on the other side of the ideological divide are not terrorists or criminals. They are people like us who happen to see certain contentious issues differently. Motive attribution symmetry, that's a mouthful. It's a term that social scientists use when the motive that you attribute to a situation is off, skewed, or crooked, or asymmetrical. In other words, you're not seeing things correctly. What I'm specifically talking about today is the phenomenon of assuming that your political ideology is based in love, while your opponent's ideology is based in hate. People often characterize this moment in our history as being angry. I wish that were true, because anger has the ability to limit itself. It is an emotion that occurs when we want to change someone's behavior and believe we can do so. While anger is often perceived as a negative emotion, research shows that its social purpose is not to drive others away, but rather to remove problems in a relationship and bring people back together. Motive attribution symmetry doesn't lead to anger because it doesn't make you want to repair the relationship. Believing your opponent is motivated by hate leads to something far worse than anger: contempt. Social scientists define contempt as anger mixed with disgust. While anger seeks to bring someone back into the fold, contempt seeks to exile. It attempts to mock, shame, and permanently exclude from relationships by belittling, humiliating, and ignoring. Signs of contempt include sarcasm, sneering, hostile humor, and worst of all, eye rolling. So while anger says, "I care about this," contempt says, "You disgust me, you are beneath caring about." You can resolve problems with someone whom you disagree, even if you disagree angrily, but you can't come to a solution with someone who holds you in contempt or for whom you have contempt. Our usual responses to someone who disagrees with us politically are, "Well, ignore the opposition. He's some random guy, right? I waste my time." Or we insult the opposition, say, "Get a life, man. Don't you have something better to do than reach out and bother a stranger?" Or destroy the opposition. Pick out 3 or 4 of his most glaring and idiotic errors and throw them in his face. Now let's take a look at this chart. This chart is the result of studies that sociologist Jonathan Haidt found of what morals humans all over the world hold closest to their hearts. This chart does not rank in any particular order. These are called the 5 foundations of morality. Number 1, compassion. Number 2, fairness. Number 3, respect for authority. Number 4, loyalty to one's group. And number 5, purity. As you can see, number 1 and number 2 are capitalized and underlined. On compassion and fairness, most of the population morally agrees. On authority, loyalty, and purity, you lose the liberals and have only the conservatives left. What is our lesson here? Compassion and fairness are nearly universal morals. Now let's see what we can learn from this chart. In fighting minimum wage increases, we often hear an argument that goes something like this: raising the minimum wage is wrong because it increases the cost of labor. If you raise the cost of labor, businesses will respond by using less of it. Firms create jobs only when adding marginal workers will generate net revenue. So if you raise the minimum wage, you are pricing cheap labor out of the market. At this point, a liberal will say, "No one can live and support a family on $8 an hour. You don't think the billionaires who own Walmart can afford to pay a few more dollars per hour? Of course they can. Who wins this debate? According to the chart, the person who made a compassion and fairness argument invoking moral values. The money argument has no moral weight. Let's try another category on the chart. Loyalty to one's group. See what the chart can teach us. During his 2008 presidential campaign, a controversy erupted because Barack Obama did not wear an American flag pin on his lapel like most candidates did in the period following the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. Obama had said in an earlier interview that he had stopped wearing the flag on his lapel after the Iraq War. "I decided I won't wear that pin on my chest," he said. "Instead, I'm going to try to tell the American people what I believe will make this country great, and hopefully that will be a testimony to my patriotism." This sparked outrage on the right. During one of the presidential debates, a voter asked Obama, "I want to know if you believe in the American flag. I'm not questioning your patriotism, but all our servicemen, policemen, and EMS wear the flag. I want to know why you do not." For many liberals, Obama's decision seemed like no big deal. For some conservatives, it was seen as unpatriotic. During the controversy, a liberal colleague of the author of this book shook her head in disbelief that anyone would care about something so trivial. And the author remembers conservative friends amazed that liberals didn't see the problem. When a Republican congressman from a very conservative district was asked, "What's the first thing that comes into your head when I say flag burning?" he replied without hesitation, "Treason." When a person on the political left was asked the same question, "What's the first thing that comes into your head when I say flag burning?" his answer, "Inadvisable." This is not to say that liberals don't love their country. Of course they do. But they put less emphasis on overt patriotism than conservatives do. Liberals are not less moral. They simply have fewer moral foundations. Liberals have a two-foundation morality, as you saw from the chart, while conservatives have a five-foundation morality. Now that we know our moral anatomy, let's address two important questions. How do we fight back, and how do we love our enemy? Number one, focus your arguments on the moral values we share, compassion and fairness, rather than those held by only one part of the population. Number two, be wary of manipulative leaders in politics and media who use the moral dimensions where we disagree as a wedge to divide us and fuel contempt. We constantly hear conservative leaders using authority, loyalty, and purity arguments as evidence that liberals are immoral and patriotic reprobates because they don't emphasize these things. Liberal leaders scream back, conservatives are some sort of American Taliban because they do care about these things. Nevertheless, if progress is our goal, then emphasizing these dimensions is unproductive. Number three, fake it until you make it. Reactive people make love a feeling. Proactive people make love a verb. Love is something you do, the sacrifices you make, the giving of self. Love is a value that is actualized through loving actions. Proactive people subordinate feelings to values. Scientific studies prove that this is true. If you're not feeling happy, move the muscles in your face into the form of a smile. Magically, moments later, you feel happier. Action follows attitude, and attitude follows action. What does this mean for you? Act like the person you want to be. One who is nice to others, decent, warm, and happy. Don't feel it, fake it. Number four, don't assume the motives of another person. One 2018 study from the Journal of Politics has revealed that the average Democrat believes that more than 40% of Republicans earn over $250,000 per year, when in fact, just 2.2% do. And Republicans believe that nearly 40% of Democrats are gay or lesbian, when just over 6% are. Number five, remember that your opponent is a human being. By defining those with whom we disagree as nothing more than a set of disembodied characteristics, you are a conservative or you are a liberal, nothing more, we put their humanity out of our own reach. Number six, almost no one is ever insulted into agreement. We can't wait for the politicians on the national stage to exhibit better behavior. We need to do it at the grassroots level. Number seven, gratitude is a contempt killer. You cannot have contempt for someone you are grateful for. Do you want to live in a one-party state? If you don't, and like it or not, you just told me you are grateful for the other party. And if you don't feel grateful, act grateful anyway. Number eight, find a friend to disagree with. This is hard, not just because you have to find them, but also because you have to listen. I have done this with my libertarian friend Danny for about 3 years, well before this book came out, and I found the following to be true. Do you want to be a more persuasive person? To make sure your ideas are well grounded, you don't get wiped out in a debate. The way to do it is not to hang around where everyone agrees. Your ideas are never challenged, and people who disagree with you are shouted down. Disagreement helps us innovate, improve, correct, and find the truth. Seeking out what those on the other side have to say will help you understand others better. You will be a stronger person, less likely to be offended or feel unsafe when you hear alternative points of view. Plus, understanding will also improve your ability to articulate and defend your own beliefs in a way that others find compelling or at least defensible. You might change a mind or two. And if your argument is weak, you'll be the first to know. What is the cure for our culture of contempt? It is not by disagreeing less, but by disagreeing better, engaging in earnest debate while still treating everyone with love and respect. Next, we will have Matters of the Heart by Anne Rostowski.
Thank you, Butch. That was really wonderful and lots of great ideas in there that you shared with us. So now if you have a joy that made you jump out of bed this morning that you'd like to share with this community, or a sorrow so sad that it's weighing down your heart, please share that as well. And if you have any gleanings on the talk too, this would be the time after our musical interlude that you can share that with this community. And now we will extinguish our chalice, but not its light, that we will carry with us into the community. We'll keep it in our hearts as we try to love our enemies. And Butch will have the closing words.
The closing words are from Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural address. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature.
Anointed.